You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I think you're going to enjoy today's podcast. We're with Robert Bordone, who's an internationally recognized expert, author, speaker, and teacher in negotiation, conflict resolution, mediation, and facilitation, recently selected as one of the top 30 negotiation professionals by the top global gurus. That sounds like a cool group. He's a senior fellow at Harvard Law School. He served on the full-time faculty at Harvard for more than 20 years. And Dr. Joel Salinas is the founder and chief medical officer of Isaac Health, a telehealth platform that focuses on brain health and dementia. He is a Harvard-trained behavioral neurologist, speaker, and writer with expertise in clinical approaches to brain health. They have co-written a book called Conflict Resilience, Negotiating Disagreement Without Giving Up or Giving In. Enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Bob and Joel, welcome to the show.
Hello. So happy to be here.
All right. So I'm going to share a thing that we're doing next month, Second City is doing and I'm doing, which normally when I share this thing with guests, they'd be like, I can't believe you're doing it. I think you're not going to be surprised. Mm-hmm. So we, my friend and colleague Tyler, Dean Kempf and myself are going to do a presentation about improvisation and mm-hmm. negotiation at a giant hostage negotiation conference in Baltimore for about 800 police officers.
Amazing. Amazing.
I love it.
And you mentioned improv a little bit in the book, but I just want your reactions on that.
I think it's fantastic. I'm just like so beyond excited to be on this pod. I'm such an improv nerd. I did improv at Improv Boston and it's just like, I feel like improv is just kind of embedded in my everyday. As I was doing it, I always felt like it's like low cost group therapy.
That's right.
You get to work through a lot of your issues through improv. But really, I mean, I felt like I kept on connecting all the neuroscience that relates to like why it's really great. But from my perspective, I mean, it's just a great way to give people an opportunity to rehearse skills and also to be able to go through the mental processing and the emotions that can come up. You know, the more vivid they make it, the more powerful the exercise. But the more you're able to rehearse a skill set or a situation, the more your brain pathways get to form and create and get those right connections that when you're in the situation, you've got a path to walk on as opposed to have to blaze a whole new trail.
Yeah, embodied practice. It's a thing that we don't necessarily do for things like this. Yeah.
Yes, and. I'm also, that's what I'm supposed to do, right? Yes, and? Is that what I'm supposed to do? Someone told me that. But this, Kelly, just from the few minutes we spoke before we went on here, negotiation has so much to learn from improv, and negotiation also is in many respects improv. One of the things that I always, you're teaching students and early on they're doing things like, oh, like I wrote out a script, and I'm like, well, kudos to you on preparation. That's not going to work because they don't have the other side of the script, right? So learning somehow to kind of be in the moment with the other, right? And the other really, really big connection here, right? The yes and is so powerful because so much I think in negotiation, people think it's like, yes, but yes, but is basically saying no. And if you're trying to persuade somebody, telling them no is not a great way to get started or move anything forward.
So let's start with how each of you came to co-write this particular book. Bob, you taught a class called The Lawyer as Facilitator. What happened in that class that led you to this idea of conflict resilience?
Yeah. So for me, I had been teaching and was teaching also at the time negotiation and conflict resolution. So this was an advanced class. And part of the idea of this class was to train lawyers to help facilitate really hard conversations across lines of difference. But what I discovered in this class, despite a huge amount of energy and effort to give skills to facilitators to sit with the discomfort of the conflict, at the end of the class, what I found most of the students doing was ensuring that as soon as disagreement, like the real meat, the emotions came into the room, they steered it away to something that was more comfortable. And what's interesting is that although folks had signed up to come in for the hard conversation, in the moment it was happening, they became complicit with the facilitator. And then later on would report that they were disappointed that they never got into anything. So all of this made me hugely fascinated with what is going on in this moment when even when we're supposedly willingly signed up for something challenging and we're trained to do it, we don't do it. And last thing I'll say about this, right, is it was kind of disappointing in the class, but also even more concerning for me to see across what was happening in the law school environment generally, in our society generally, even in our families. And it made me feel like I need to write about this. I need to explore it more. And enter Dr. Salinas.
Yeah. So, Joelle, you had a similar experience with your students and colleagues, right?
Yeah. You know, I think with increasing loneliness and social isolation, you know, this has been a big part of my research. I just kept on wondering, what is the cause here? Like, what is so different about today that makes it harder to be connected with? And there's so many reasons for it, right? There's so many reasons. But one of the things that came up as I was, when I met Bob and we were talking about what he was seeing, was that there is this element where it's just become harder for people to engage with each other in social interactions, which by default will almost definitely have conflict, right? Because we are not sharing the same body. We're not sharing the same brain. At some point, the left hand and the right hand want to do something different. And so we have to figure out how to navigate that. And sure, we have socio-emotional learning done when we're in elementary school, but not everybody gets that. And we also don't have like refreshers. We don't have like advanced courses, right?
I know the guy who needs social-emotional learning, Joelle. I mean, you are in a high-end place.
Public schools. but it is something that I think we all could benefit from. And I think also kind of selfishly, it was something that I saw in myself, right? Always been very avoidant when it comes to conflict. And seeing in the hospital setting, not just in myself, but in colleagues, among patients, nursing staff, consultants, situations escalate pretty quickly or progressively get worse due to people avoiding too much or like steamrolling through the conflict. Right. Like it's just this way and that's the only way. And I think if we would be better at being comfortable with sitting with and being with conflict and learn that skill set and that mindset, we'd be so much better equipped to exist, like to be human. And I think the last thing I'll say about this is just the fact of the matter is if we really are looking for connection, you really can't have connection without conflict. Without conflict, there's no connection. So it's just an essential skill for us to actually get along.
Yeah, I mean, this is true in theater and comedy and all that, which is a representation of the world we live in, which is, mm-hmm. if you're in conflict, guess what? Boring. No one mm-hmm.
does that. Yeah.
So one of the things that zero-sum game has always been a problem, feels worse today. I don't know if it is. It feels worse.
I think it is worse, unfortunately. A part of the reason why, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, right? I mean, but I think part of the reason why is that there's something in this moment that is it feels very short term. And it feels very much framed as winning, right? We're all about winning. We're winning, we're winning. And if you look at a short term and you like, you could say there's a lot of winning maybe, except for the fact that, you know, nations, friendships, family connections, workplaces, usually extend beyond a single conflict or a single negotiation. And interests are more than substantive, like, you know, what is our GDP? Or did I smash you in that argument? And once you start to actually get people to think more long term, right, it gets more complicated and we get out of zero sum. But I feel like there's a moment, unfortunately, where that short term, like, quote unquote, get results thinking is dominating. And honestly, like, I think there's a lot of skill stuff we can do. But this is where I really feel like our book offers something around, like, what is going on in our brains that is making that decision feel like a really good one and a right one? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, you know, I mean, part of what's been so much fun about this collaboration for me, I want, you know, Joelle will probably actually say something actually responsive to that prompt about what, but it's like, why do people, like, just as a layperson or as a lawyer, like, why do people do things that don't ultimately serve them in the long term, even though they feel like nice in the moment? And that question seems really important to me.
Yeah, we had Kurt Gray on the podcast, who has a terrific book called Outraged right now. And his theory is that we're all coming from a harm-based moral point of view. So, you know, where do we think we're harmed? So maybe on the right, you're worried about immigrants. And maybe on the left, you're also worried about immigrants, but in a different way in terms of their care. And if we're working from that, I think that your book centers this process, right, that starts with self. And yes. I think that's really important. It's not necessarily something I've seen in a lot of these negotiation books that I've read in the past we start with the pie. We start and I get all that, but like the pie doesn't matter if you're not walking in and understanding what you believe
exactly.
What your values are, right?
Yeah, we give the analogy. It's like how do you expect to learn how to cook if you can't stand the heat of the kitchen?
Right.
And you know this point about what drives the difficulty in these exchanges, you know, our brain is really amazing. You know, we've been very fortunate to be in a species that's evolved this incredible organ that has, you know, hundreds of trillions of connections and like just billions of neurons. But at its core, it's a forecasting machine. It's telling us what's likely to happen. And as a result, it's telling us what's good and what's bad. And when it's telling what's good, it's the rewards that we're chasing. And when it's bad, it's the threats to avoid or to look out for. And so even kind of to your point about kind of that harm-based approach from a previous interview, all that is just your brain learning what is likely to cause harm or threat. What is danger? And in recording that danger, your brain will have all sorts of alarms set up for whenever it's detecting a potential threat, that rustling of the saber-toothed tiger potentially from that sound that's around the corner. And conflict is a big one, right? We grow up, and if we aren't taught from a young age, from examples around us and directly being taught that conflict can be really good, we will see conflict as bad, we'll see it as harmful, we see it as a sign that something's not working. Some of us see it as the deathly threat to the self. And so we kind of have to relearn or unlearn all of these kind of pathways that we have, so that way the next time conflict does come up, we're able to overcome that response of kind of fight or flight that can emerge.
And you know what I would say, Kelly, on this, right? I mean, the starting with the self, you know, from a book sales perspective might not help us too much, because it's like, I want to figure out how to work with this like impossible person. And it's like the first three chapters are like, first you have to work on yourself, right? At the same time, like in all of the work that I have done, it is always the case that part of what is making it so complicated are the internal conflicts that we haven't unearthed. And that is, I think, both at a psychological level and a brain level, they're connected. So I think our readers will see that there is a not only like a neuroscience piece, there's a bit of an internal family systems piece in there. Because we can teach you skills in a simulation class, but, and that's important, right? I mean, I'm all for that. At the same time, when it's like starring you in your life, right? You have to have that capacity to sit with that all internal conflictedness, that discomfort. And so that personal work just matters so much. And I'm making a guess here, and Kelly and Joelle, you could tell me I'm wrong, right? But part of that kind of process of the discomfort, which I'm imagining comes from also improv, yeah, is seeing kind of the reward at the end, right? In our book, we call it the BBO, the bigger, better offer. But I'm imagining the process of improv, of going up there without a script and in front of an audience with folks that you're just going to ham it up a bit, is not comfortable and easy. But there's something on the other side.
No, and Joel knows this because he took classes. The early classes are all sort of a level of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about this idea of holding conflict. And in our work, what we talk about is like, all right, you have to reserve judgment of self and judgment of others. We got to get you out of your fear and shame brain. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the language we use. But and then you're basically going in empty in the best way possible.
Mm.
You have everything to draw on, that the person across from you is there to save you. So it's just, but we're able to create these artificial norms in these spaces. And often we don't have these sort of agreements. And you talk about that in your book, but I want to dig into holding conflict because I really think that's such an essential step. So I like, and I'm curious, did that concept just, you had it already, or is like the word came to you, you're like, yes, this is it. Where'd that come from?
I mean, we really developed it. Yeah, we developed it. We were trying to figure out how do we communicate what is conflict resilience at its core? Because I think there's a conceptual sense to it, and yeah, I'm very kind of like scientifically minded, so I always want to break things down to their component parts and figure out how the pieces come together. And for us, conflict holding was this recognition piece and also this tolerance element. Go ahead, Bob.
No, go. You finish. Sorry.
Yeah. It's really just, do you recognize things as conflict? How likely are you to recognize things as conflict? Mm-hmm. Is every little bit of a disagreement in the life-threatening situation versus you don't even pay attention to it? And the tolerance piece is, can you handle the stress or the distress of your body in that situation? Does being in a light disagreement feel like the end of the world for you, like at a kind of visceral level, or does it not even bother you at all? Does it not even kind of create any kind of level of arousal or sense of negativity? And Bob and I have very different thresholds for these things. Bob, I don't know if you want to say something about this.
Yeah. I mean, part of when I started to interrupt you actually was just, you know, there's something both, I mean, autobiographic about those concepts and also just, I mean, seeing them come up in my own work. But just the autobiography, I mean, just for the funny story between Joelle and I, right, is that, and I think this is probably by dint of both personality and training and is that there's just a whole set of discussions that I experience as debates, as like, that was fun. Like, and as a kid, I would be like this, right? In high school, I would like talk to, you know, my best friend, and we'd talk for like 3 hours on some policy issue because, yes, I am a nerd. And I would be like in disagreement with him. And then at the end, I'd be like, yeah, that was fun. Like, I basically agree with you, Glenn. And he would get like apoplectic with me. And I'd be like, well, it just was fun doing that. And sometimes I, with Joelle and I, like we'll have a thing and I'd be like, oh, that was great. But I think Joelle's kind of conflict holding or conflict really recognition, I mean, that's a term we use in the book, is different from mine. So he might be worried about, are we on the same page? Like, is Bob really upset with me? I sleep soundly. But that conflict holding idea, Joel, you want to say something? I can tell.
No, I just, it's just so true. Like, I will not sleep for days just wondering, like, did I say something? Did we do something? Or like, what's going on? And like, I'll just obsess over it.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay, I just say, Kelly, what makes it work? Like, part of what we talk about in the book is once folks can understand that difference, it helps us find a way of engaging around the difference that doesn't, that isn't about like, oh my gosh, like, I mean, I don't want to keep someone up for nights and nights when I just had a good time, right? On the other hand, what ends up happening if you don't find a way to talk about it is I just start to say, I guess I have to be really tender around him because he's going to melt, right? Or Joelle says, Bob is a big, big ass bully.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a know-it-all, mm-hmm. which is like a bad outcome for both of us.
Yeah. I think the thing that we don't talk enough about is the sort of cognitive overload that all of us are dealing with every single day. I literally had this conversation with a colleague today because it's been, for both of us, a really hard week, a rewarding week. A lot of stuff. I've had like 3 podcasts and I had to negotiate a few things. And on the one hand, I'm really proud of some of the interactions I had. On the other hand, I was realizing I was stressing myself out and making bad decisions. Mm. And I needed to like take the breath, take the beat. And we all read about this stuff, right? We encounter it. We know the science behind it. And yet we're just, I said, one of the jokes I always say at Second City is, we go teach this stuff, but we're doctors who smoke. We'll yeah. come here and like, yes, Anne goes out the effing door because it's like, nope, don't like it. And like, what are we doing? We know better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You also, though, sometimes the thing that you're like maybe least naturally good at is the thing you want to like dig into and learn more about, right?
Oh, the me search, sure.
Yeah, you know.
All right. I'm trying to imagine your editor reading the mirror work, chair work, table work, and being like, I'm not doing that.
So you need to say a little more about that. Say more.
So I want you to explain what mirror work and chair work and table work is. And what I'm going to say is it's very similar to when companies hire us and then people are like, seriously, you're going to make me do improv. And then they do it and it's all fine.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what you are talking about is an embodied practice. The same thing that improv is. So I also want to set the stage because you referenced this earlier. You know, scrimmaging is fine, but you can't just scrimmage. So you know, we don't really do role-playing at Second City. We do skills building around things like listening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you know, elite athletes, they play catch before a baseball game. Elite musicians do scales. And yet, I think in all of our experiences, whether you're talking about like a business experience or in other cases, we don't apply the same to our performance. Mm-hmm. And I think these elements, mirror work, chair work, and table work are that kind of embodied practice.
Mm. Yeah, I want to say it is 100% embodied. And I need to credit, I think we need to credit like colleagues that, you know, I've worked with for years around psychodrama and internal family systems.
Yep.
So the mirror work piece, which is identifying these different kind of sides of ourself or stories, right? You know, to pick an example, I mean, an example that kind of came up for me many, many years is teaching, you know, hundreds of law students, you know, a third of them have no business being in law school. And of that third, probably 10% should be, you know, working with you, Kelly. right. But there's a side of them that feels like my family sacrificed a lot. I don't want to be disappointment. And there's another side of like, but this is what's like, this is what jazzes me in the world. And whatever, that's a very simple example. But how do you identify those sides accurately? And that's what we mean by mirror, as opposed to putting over a layer of judgment of this is the side that wants to do improv is the selfish, unrealistic side. And the generous, good son or daughter side is the one that's going to dutifully gubby the lawyer. Mirror work, right? But then the chair work, and this is where it gets really embodied, is literally giving someone chairs. I mean, in my coaching work, I actually will say, like, now we're going to set up chairs. And Kelly, you get the same reaction. Like, they're like, what? Like, are you, like I think I could just do it in this chair. I'm like, No, let's do the chairs anyway, right? like, let's just get the chairs and let's move around. And let's give each of those chairs a voice and even be in conversation with each other. Cause that's also where you start to see certain dynamics come up. Like, for example, just to continue to use this little example, the selfish chair, sorry, the I'll be a lawyer, good son chair, ends up saying to the other one, you know what? Silencio, you're bad. And it's like, well, how do you get that side to stand up for itself? Because that is the entryway into the most authentic, the most effectively assertive, and I think this sounds counterintuitive, but actually the most vulnerable opening, which is there's a side of me that feels like I want, you know, that's really important for me to not let you down and to be a success in the family. And there's a side of me that also feels like there's this other thing in me that needs to breathe and have some life. And that's what I want to talk to you about. And we've done this very simply, right? I think the ability to kind of sit in those chairs, give them voice, is quite empowering. And at the table, and here's the other thing, right? At the table, if one chair automatically gets silenced, if you've done that chair work, and I've had like clients and actually in my own life, sometimes I've been like, you know, I've just said this thing, but before we go, I think there's another side of me I need to represent here.
Yeah.
Or there's another chair that needs to be, I mean, literally say chair, another side. So I don't, that Joelle, like, I mean, because there's a lot going on in the brain there. I mean, I'm kind of talking about it from a very practice base of work that I do.
Yeah, I think what's happening in situations like this is if there is dissonance, there's likely going to be some almost like leakage of that into other networks that are leading to more of that sense of distress. So your heart rate might go up, your blood pressure will go up, your muscles will contract. Some people, you know, their palms get cold. Some people get flushed. Some people, like, their positioning will change. Like, I know when I feel like I'm in a threatening position, like, I clench my fist and I actually, like, hunch forward. And I'm almost, like, getting into the fetal, protection position.
Yeah.
And that also affects the way that you're thinking, right? Because the sense of threat will make you focus a lot more on getting the threat away. So shutting down the conversation or moving away from it. So unless you're able to learn how to unearth these uncomfortable truths, right? Two truths being true, and it's gonna lead to distress. That's gonna make it harder for you to reach that bigger, better offer, the BBO that we talk about with engaging in the conflict.
It's interesting because I don't. Most people don't dispute mind-body conversations,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't set in for me until actually. Read The Extended Mind by Annie Murphy Paul, the science writer, who has a whole couple chapters on there's a chapter on memorization with regard to actors learning their lines during blocking, mm-hmm. the physical act of moving in space, and mm-hmm. and how your body is telling your mind maybe before your mind is
right.
Your body. And in therapy, literally in therapy, until I started doing gesture work and EMR and that sort of stuff, everything sort of came out.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, wow, this is much more deep, which is why the chair work is, it might seem, we have to figure out how to, like, let people know that this is the least silly thing. It's science-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah. Kelly, I was going to ask you, I know you're supposed to interviewing us, but I'm so curious how you handle resistance when it comes up, because I definitely get it sometimes.
Yeah. We're lucky in that when they're doing these very low stakes exercises, it feels good and it's funny. Mm. So they start laughing. And if you have an exercise where you have to look someone in the eye, which a lot of our stuff does, that is also pleasing to people because it's a connective sort of thing.
Mm.
There will on occasion be the dude who crosses his arms who won't play. And I guarantee you 9 times out of 10, that's why we're there is because of that guy.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. And I talk about this. There are situations in which we're like, can't help you. You don't play.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we know we're going to get there. And for the most part, people are going to respond because synchrony is so powerful. This is the other thing we're doing that maybe that you're not, which is I got a group that's going to be in synchrony.
Mm.
And that just, we did this here. The leadership team, you know, we had Second City got bought a few years ago, pretty much new leadership team. I'm one of the only old guard left, but we took a beginning improv class together, and I could tell, like, our CEO was like walking down, like, and afterwards he was like, that was incredible.
Wow. Yeah.
We should talk about table. We should talk about table work. Just the last leg on that.
Oh yeah. Joel, do you want to take table work?
With table work is the actual moment where you're with the person across from you. And that's where there's this concept that I like, which is mise en place. It's everything in its place. You see that in cooking. And you want to be prepared for the conversation. So it's the right setting. You want to have an agenda. And it all depends on the specific situation. So it's really this, doing the strategic thinking around what is it that you want to accomplish. We talk about in the book a lot about purpose, like what is the purpose of this conversation, because that'll also help to drive how you set the setting, the timing. You know, there's a situation that can come up where at the end of a meeting everything's wrapped up and somebody just says something really inflammatory, like they drop an F-bomb, or they say, actually, this is a thing that I want to do, or I think you're totally incompetent. That's not the time to really engage in a big conversation, right? And so we want to make sure that when people are learning the skills around table work, that they're thinking about the purpose of the engagement and also thinking about the whole environment, the person in front of them, how they're feeling. If you're ill or tired, fatigued because you haven't been sleeping, that's going to be sending all sorts of mixed messages to your brain, which makes it so much harder for you to actually be on your A game. And if you're in a place where it's really busy, there's lots of noise, lots of distraction, you're certainly not going to be able to listen either.
Did you reference mise en place in your book? I don't recall that you did.
Sounds like we should have, but I don't think we did.
Because yeah, yeah. It's in the book I'm reading right now. I literally just read this book called Meaningful Work.
Yeah.
Chris Adams and Tamara Miles. I'm interviewing them next week. And I have all these markers. They talk about Second City and improv, so I was excited about that. Then they talk about orientation programs. And they use the mise en place metaphor, which I loved.
Me too.
It really got me thinking, like, we do not do good prep work. We don't even do it here at Second City in terms of, like, And it's so available to us here. We have stories. We have culture. We have rights. Like, so I talked to our CEO today, and I'm like, let's make it mandatory. First week that someone starts here, one of us takes them to a show. Like, why would you? They're going to be delighted. They're going to have the best time. And they get, but you take them, and you're like, this is now you. And then the purpose and the meaning is all going to come through, because they're going to be like, oh, our part of our job is spreading joy. Everyone's gonna get behind that.
Hey Kelly, can I say, I think this is the weird double bind of conflict, right? Because we are so avoided, many of us, that the thought of the preparation, right, is also distasteful. And so from a position of, you know, folks who do this work, it's like mind-boggling, like, okay, this is a really important, really hard conversation for you that you'd like just kind of blundered your way into. Why would you ever do that? But of course, it's like, well, who wants to do all this work that also feels unpleasant, except for the fact that it's going to increase likelihood that you're going to just do it better, right? And I always found this to be the case teaching negotiation to law students. And never mind difficult conversations or conflict, but it's like if they're preparing a deposition, they spend like zillions of hours. Like the client is paying like hundreds of thousands of dollars for a deposition or something, right? Or a cross-examination or an opening argument. But if they're like preparing for the pretrial settlement, it's like the back of an index card as they're driving in and they wing it. Mind-boggling to me.
There's so much I want to talk about. all right. And we only have so much time. One of the things that I thought was really interesting, and this has come up a lot here, is the studies around trigger warnings and trauma survivors.
Yeah.
And this idea that they aren't necessarily beneficial to people who have experienced actual trauma.
Yeah, it's a tricky subject. And I think, actually, before I even dive into that, I think it's really, really important that people know that when we're talking about conflict resilience, we're not saying put up with abuse, right? We're not saying to put yourself in a situation that is directly harming you. The idea behind conflict resilience is really focused on kind of conflicts and disagreements that make you uncomfortable, maybe give you a little bit of a distress, and we want you to be better equipped to engage in the dialogue so you get something better out of that relationship or that situation. So we're very specific about even giving advice on how to think through, you know, when do you try to stay and work on the situation, and when is it time for you to walk away? And kind of at the core of that is, you know, is the other person acting in bad faith or not? Mm-hmm. It's challenging. This takes a lot of self-reflection, but certainly we don't want people to put themselves in a dangerous situation. Now, when it comes to trigger warnings, part of the reason why we brought that into the book is to make sure that people also understand that we have a cultural expectation around making sure that we warn people about potential discomfort, and the true kind of like meaning behind a trigger warning is to avoid somebody from going into major psychological distress or having a major psychological slip back. But sometimes trigger warnings get conflated with just discomfort or awkwardness or the potential for unpleasantness. And what happens is that if you identify more and more with the fact that you might be uncomfortable with a trigger, that actually increases the volume or the vividness of the distress of that trigger, and actually is not helpful for you. So there's this element of being able to expose yourself to a little bit of discomfort that will build up your resistance to it, to help you to tolerate it a little bit better or to adapt to it. Kind of like when you're a baby and growing up, if you sometimes you're encouraged to like eat dirt and kind of like muck around with stuff, because that builds up your immune system. And what Bob and I really drove a lot of this book is just feeling that we're almost allergic to conflict these days. And so we want to be able to just be much more comfortable with it and not feel as kind of roiled in a ton of distress that we can't handle when we're in conflict situations.
There was a director of ours who went to a university production of A Streetcar Named Desire, and there was a sign outside the theater that said, "This play may or may not contain a rape." And I was like, "You've just made this way worse."
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just feel so much anxiety from that. Like, what am I to do? Should I go in? Should I not go in?
Am I going to look for it? Like, you've introduced a cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, that is like, well, that's the job of the play, by the way.
Yeah.
That is the job of the play to introduce these ideas so that we can safely play with them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what you've done is ruined one of the incredible aspects of theater, and you've mentioned psychodrama. It's like, these things are all connected.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why do you think theater happened in the first place? Is because we needed a representation of ourselves that was not ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Can I say two things on this, Kelly? One is kind of a funny story. The other is some very intentional thing we did in the book. When you read about the pieces on setting up space, this is more in the last part of the book around commitment, we really avoid use of the word creating a safe space. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is done not – we want to. I think we use the word low risk. We want to create a space that encourages conflict resilience, that brings differences forward in a way that makes it as possible to hold as you can. But the notion somehow that you could bring real people who have strong views with real emotions, histories, and stories, and, you know, as Joelle said several times, right, complicated brains into a space that will feel completely safe is a promise we can't keep. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone can actually say that safely. So that's the one thing I'm going to say. The other thing is just related to like a play or this is not in her book, but it's kind of, to me, it was a funny story. So one of my former colleagues at Harvard Law School who taught family law told this story. So this is, by the way, family law. It's going to be a lot of emotions, feelings, histories. First day of class, a student comes up to her and says, "Oh, excuse me, professor, are there going to be trigger warnings in this class?" And she responded, "I am a walking trigger, and so is this class." But the notion somehow that we can get into the stuff of life in a way that avoids we don't know when we're stepping on each other's triggers, because even a really, like, you know, there was like a simulation in our class, which was just like, you know, a business conflict. Mm-hmm. Well, if you feel like you were cheated in a small, closely held business experience, that can be as triggering as the last case, which is a divorce that involves family custody. And so I found that, I mean, I think Joelle, you found the research on that, which I loved. I only have stories and a sense of kind of felt experience.
I mean, I think one thing that in this conversation, what's really important is that we're not aiming to invalidate the experience of somebody who feels a lot of distress around certain topics. Right. I think there's this improv concept that has really stuck with me for forever, which is the see and be seen.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that these skills are instilling in you the power not just to kind of sit there and just listen, right? Listening is hard enough to do, but also to effectively assert yourself. And effectively asserting yourself includes kind of bringing up that yeah, this topic is uncomfortable for me for very specific reasons that I don't want to go into right now. So it may be harder for me to have a conversation around it. So I'd prefer if we could do it in person or in an environment that's a little bit more private, or I might need a little bit more time to respond. And that's okay. That's an important thing to stipulate so that way you can still engage in the dialogue.
And what I love too is you give so many different examples of different ways people can sort of model these things, these ideas, these tenets. And one of them that I loved was you talk about Roger Fisher at his Harvard class, and he created this norm.
Mm.
Can you tell that story? And then I'm going to ask you for your yes answer.
Yeah. I mean, so if Roger Fisher, who's kind of, was a mentor of mine and someone who, I mean, really founded the field of principled or interest-based negotiation. But he had this way. So, of course, a guy who is revered and has a lot of authority. But often the way he would change a norm was by example, by never saying anything. This particular example, you have a class of 120 people. And at the end of class, a lot of people leave. This is not nice, but they would leave their coffee or their, the plate from their bagel, their napkins. And as students were filing out, he would go and just start to pick up the coffee cups and throw them away, pick up the plates. And within 2 or 3 weeks, everybody is bringing their coffee cup and empty coffee cup and plate out, right? Mm-hmm. And it never said a word, right? It was this kind of modeling. And this ability to kind of change a culture. And I just love that. And I particularly love it because he could have just from the front of the room said, hey, people, clean up after yourself. Mm-hmm. And people would have. But I like that he didn't do that. And I think we use it very much as an example of, hey, if you're low power in an organization, you might not be able to change all the rules. But the things you do, people will notice. And that can change kind of organizational cultural norms.
I believe this 1,000%. And I remember when our new owners came in, and they told me about this later because I didn't remember it. We were touring the building, and I've worked here 37 years.
Mm.
This same building.
Where did you start when you were like 10?
21. It was my, okay. my first gig out of college.
Okay.
But I, if I see garbage on the floor, I pick it up and I throw it out. Why wouldn't you? And later these guys were like, well, we knew you were okay when you were picking up the garbage. And I'm like, it is a modeling. So if there's dirty dishes, I will do them. And it sends a message to everyone, especially if you've got high status, mm-hmm. That's like, hey, this is the norm I want. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's do yes and stories. Joelle, can we start with you?
Sure. Yeah. This is it's an important skill that I've learned with working with patients. I work with patients who have neurological conditions, and they can have all sorts of behavioral difficulties as a result of that, including kind of being very inappropriate, yelling and screaming at you, telling you to go away, telling you to leave you. And in all those situations, it's been so invaluable to come in with that yes and kind of positioning, mm-hmm. because yes, you're uncomfortable, and I'd like to ask you one more question. Or yes, you see that there's a hallucination, like you see people in the room that aren't there, and can you tell me a little bit more about what you're specifically seeing and how you feel about it? And it helps to kind of move the conversation along. And these are things that we also, in the work that I do with Isaac Health, where we work with patients and families affected by dementia, because your loved one may have forgotten something doesn't mean that you have to really stick to it, right? It means that you can say yes, and let's talk about the next thing, or yes, and let's have dinner. So that way you just keep the conversation going, you help to preserve the relationship, and you can find something new about it without kind of being stuck in like the little battle of every single moment.
Yeah, we literally created a improv for caregivers program with the Cleveland Clinic and a group across generations. And it was caregivers and the people they're caring for. And the yes and was mind-blowing in regard to the ability of like, oh, we can follow this story. And because they're in their reality and you're in your reality. And I, you know, as we know, our realities are not necessarily the reality for all of us.
Right.
I love that. Bob.
I'm going to share one from years ago. I think it's one that really shifted how I think about actually the power of conflict. And this was two people I worked with who often worked with each other. And I knew that one of them really did not like working with the other. Thought the person was not that skilled. Smart, but not skilled in the kind of teaching piece. And I was enlisted to kind of be, I wasn't really a mediator. I was just the I've almost like witnessed to the conversation.
Yeah.
But this person so beautifully was able to say, yes, I think you're brilliant and I respect you. And I actually really like hanging out with you. Like you're really fun. And I don't think we're a good combination in the room together. I think we have like very different views about the pedagogy. And that was not an easy conversation, but their friendship actually grew more after that. And they didn't end up being in a classroom again together. But there was something about not like just saying both of these things from my experience are true. Didn't mean that the other person, the other end was like, okay, they might say, you know, in that case, to hell with you. Right. I mean that, but in this case, there was something about both the way in which it was done and I felt like the honesty that created some space for, okay, like it's one of the things we always say, right? It's like, I now know your yes is a yes and your no is a no. And that just makes it easier. So that's and it was a real learning for me because I would have been the person who just would have been like, I hope this person disappears. Or something, you know.
it's really hard. We're not taught this, and I've only picked it up, quite frankly, I think this year. This idea of separating, seeing someone's humanness, their mind, their soul, all that, and they might not be right for this thing. and those are completely two. Like I can honor you, I can love you, I can like you, and you can be not right for this thing.
Yeah.
And you're probably beautifully right for this other thing.
Yeah.
So like, but. Again, holding two opposite ideas in our head at the same time, hard stuff.
Really hard. And particularly when you might be touching on one of the others, you know, either their story of themselves, or your story of yourself, which is that you don't do something that can be experienced as hurtful.
That's right.
Because you can both really like and appreciate somebody and also say something that will be felt and will be hurtful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a terrific book. It's called Conflict Resilience, Negotiating Disagreement Without Giving Up or Giving In. Joelle and Bob, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
being grown for the rest of your life from adulthood. No one survives.